This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 136, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 120 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week I'm talking to Elizabeth Anglin about her book, Experience, Memoirs of an Abducted Childhood. Starting in 1990, Elizabeth researched transpersonal psychology through the Center for Psychology and Social Change, now the John E. Mack Institute, and became peer mentor for people undergoing extreme spiritual emergencies, especially anomalous extraterrestrial experiences. She appears as experiencer Anne in John E. Mack's book Abduction and spoke at the Abduction Studies Conference at MIT in May 1992 and at the forum at the Macht Building for the Committee of Inquiry at Harvard University in 1995. She's a Reiki master, a medical intuitive, remote viewer and evidential spirit medium. Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. Anytime. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So we're going to be talking about your book, which is called Experience, Memoirs of an Abducted Childhood. I just wanted to ask, because I read so much of your book and you had so many experiences close to your house, I just wanted to check. Your house wasn't in a crowded suburb, was it?
No, we were in a fairly rural area. It had been, the house itself had originally been a Quaker meeting house. This woman who's quite famous, who's now that I'm on the spot, I can't remember her name. She was famous in the area for being part of the Underground Railway, where she would go down to Toledo, Ohio, and pick up escaped slaves. And they would come to the farm and be taught to read and write, and then also how to manage farms. So the house was in this neighborhood, an old Quaker neighborhood. We had a Quaker meeting house, like a very minimal religion. The Quakers believed in spirit mediumship, but they would always, so the friends would sit around and they would just channel what they thought God was saying. So everybody was equal. There was spiritual equality, and a Quaker meeting was. And so anyway, that was the house. So the house had a spiritual component to it. And so the land around it was orchards from the original farm. We had apple trees in our, we had horses. So we were on 10 acres. Our neighbors had 60 acres. The orchard next door was 60 acres. Behind us was 16 square miles of farmland that was just open land with ravines and creeks and a high tension power line running through it to the town, Adrian, Michigan, which a lot of stuff happened by that high tension power line. So if you've got high tension power lines, look at them. And you think there are aliens around. You know, it was kind of an idyllic, now that I look back on it. We had the typical Gen X parents who let us do anything, even though it might kill us, and run around the woods. We didn't have, you know, poisonous snakes or anything like that. So we were fairly safe. And we didn't know we had cougars until we found out that they let out I saw a black cougar when I was 17 with my younger brother. That's when I realized I'd been running around land that had cougars on it. So mountain lions are scary, you know, but we didn't know that.
I was going to ask you about the book in that it starts with stories from when you were 3 years old. So You've been having these encounters your whole life. But I wanted to ask you first about, you had a waking dream and you were in a room where your father was in a chair. And the ETs had a gun?
Yeah, it was one of those typical implements they used to work on your head. It wasn't really a gun. A lot of their medical implements, you could say, oh, that's a gun. But what it really is sort of a laser within a ceramic matrix that sort of goes through physical reality to the point where they want it to do work. So they can just kind of basically slide that through they basically just sort of go through our physical reality to a point that they want to work on, and they calibrate those things to not leave holes in your head, you know, when they work on your head, if they're working on something they left in your head, like an implant or something like that, then they would put that up to your head and work on your head. And you would be immobilized, because if you move, that can really mess things up. It's a fine kind of working that they're doing. And so my dad was immobilized, and they were putting this thing up to his head. And I kind of got up enough adrenaline, I believe, as a little kid by screaming, which to me sounded like somebody with a bandsaw, you know, and it was me and screaming and basically saying, oh, no, you can do anything you want to him. Just don't shoot my daddy in the head. Because all I knew were like cop shows where people, if somebody stuck a gun to somebody's head, they were going to shoot him and he was going to be dead. Right. I didn't really, my conscious mind, my worldly mind did not really fathom that these were aliens and they weren't intending to kill them, and that, you know, it wasn't like, you know, something I'd seen on TV. So, you know, I was pleading with them not to kill my dad, these bad men, but they had to be bad men, because who else would kidnap somebody and, you know, strap them to a chair or immobilize them to a chair and put something to their head that looked like a gun, even though it was their kind of gun. That was my first memory. It was like I woke up and got really, really conscious in my normal earthly mind in the middle of an experience. And the next thing I know, I was falling in my bed to the extent that it really hurt. And I think what they did is they just grabbed me and said, let's get her out of here. She's a pain in the butt. And, you know, zipped me back home and went plonk, you know, the three-year-old, you know, a really feisty three-year-old. So, yeah, I remember that. And, you know, the rest of the story is what's even more concerning, was that my dad was having an experience. He was at school at Berkeley, or University of California, Berkeley, in botany for his master's. And he was a biology teacher, and he was trying to, you know, get his PhD at the time. He gave up on it from that experience and came home, because he knew he was having experience. He had had that night for him, or that day for him, he was on a field trip with a bunch of botany students going up a mountain pass in the Sierras. And those mountain passes are dirt roads. And, you know, it's high, steep mountains on one side. And there was a high, steep mountain on the right and a drop off on the left. And all of a sudden, there's this little silver spaceship coming down in the road in front of the bus. And the last thing he remembered was seeing this silver spaceship in the road come down, and the bus driver panicked, turning around and trying to back down the mountain pass to get away from the silver spaceship, and then missing time. And they missed 9 hours on that bus. When my mom finally got a hold of him and told him that I was, you know, wanting to know if he was okay and had the bad men killed him and he came home, because this thing had just happened to him. And he was like, oh, crap. You know, this is also happening to my daughter. And he knew, he didn't tell me his entire life, but he knew from when he was a child that he had been an abductee. And I had to wait until I met to find out his whole story. So anyway, he stopped trying to get a PhD and he came home and he tried to protect me. He didn't do a good job. I mean, it's kind of hard to do, but that's the first thing in the book. And that's one of my earliest memory. I've gone back since and remote viewed when my earliest experience was, and it was in utero. And my mom had a terrible, terrible time with me in her. And she, you know, was always going to the doctor and always feeling bad, and remote viewed it. That they were on top of me from the time I was in the body, in my mama's body. So
I was going to ask if you suspect that perhaps your grandfather might have had experience as well.
Yes, my grandfather, my dad's dad, they were from Northwest Alabama, the poorest part of Alabama, Marion County, Alabama. The most different part of Alabama. There's a few counties in Alabama that fought for the North instead of the South. Well, they were they were those people. They were the people who were poor, and so they were no better off than the people who were slaves, but for the most part. Anyway, Marion County, Alabama, just to the north of Hamilton, Alabama, my grandfather, grandmother, and dad had 40 acres, and they had, they were not rich. They had cotton, and my grandfather had a still, and he made moonshine, and he ran from the revenue man. So, and yet he told really good jokes, and people liked him. But, you know, he was poor. But he was going to Hackleburg, Alabama, to get supplies, and there was a back way to get to Hackleburg on the back roads from the farm that was quicker. It saved probably an hour and a half to 2 hours of time. And one day he was going to Hackleburg and there was a spaceship in the road and he missed time. And he never took the back way to Hackleburg again. He was terrified of it. You couldn't get him to go on that road. So, and this was probably the 30s or 40s, maybe even the 50s. It was when my dad was a kid, so it was probably 40s. My dad was born in 1936. So, but you could not get him to go on the road, the back road to Hackleburg to save his life. He'd go around, he'd take the extra time and spend the extra gas money. So we had that. My dad knew about that. My dad used to get, he remembered from when he was little, like 3 years old, walking out between the sheets on the line that my grandmother had put on the line. And then there being little white men on the other side of the sheets and them taking him off and then him missing time and getting into trouble because nobody could find it. And he couldn't tell them where he was. It's in the family. Its psychic ability is in the family, but most notably not through my grandfather, but through my grandmother's mother, who I never met. Her name was Rebecca. She was known to be quite a good psychic healer and a midwife. I don't know what happened with her. I don't know much about her story other than that. They used to say to me, "You're just like Rebecca." And I'm like, "I don't know who that is."
If you look at that then, and it goes back through your family, does that give you an idea of why they may be doing it? If it's generational, why the ET's picking you all up?
The lucky thing for me is my dad was a biology teacher, right? And he was a biology teacher in the 12th best public school in the United States. A school that a C average was like an A average. It was easy for my high school to get into a Harvard, for example, or to get into a better school because the school was just so freaking good, right? So I knew from a young age, I think, about things like genetics. We had horses. We would go to horse sales and look at, you know, we would look at how horses were built and then we'd look at their genetic lines and things like that. So also, I know that not everything presences. So like not every one of my brothers and sisters is an abductee because they probably genetically did not express what was in their genetic makeup to express, but I did. And then also spiritually, there is a, you know, who are you in terms of the spirit and why are you coming in? And there's a spiritual component too, which is more likely to make the genes that you have express what's in them to express that they're looking for. So I was pretty lucky in understanding genetics. I'm just going to say right there, it's like, oh, right. Yeah. Okay. So my dad, my grandfather, my maternal grandmother had some of these genetics and they were part Cherokee. They were part Native American, both sides, my grandfather and my great grandmother, my grandmother. So, although, you know, you can't really tell with the green eyes and the dark hair that I'm any part Cherokee, I am. And they were definitely more Cherokee than I am. So the Cherokee have a long lineage of having a little white man who comes to take the children away and teach them things. And it's not something that you hear about because they don't share that with white people because white people have their own, you know, they have their Jesus and, you know, science and nothing else. So, but they had, you know, sometimes their kids would go missing and the kid would be out with the little white man who was teaching them things, the teacher. I remember that from a kid, that a lot of my missing time experiences, I'd be learning something. I'd be learning something about frogs and the environment and ecology. But also my dad was into that stuff too. Was chicken egg? Was it because he was an experiencer and he had a little white man teacher? You know, what? We don't know. Probably. There are things that they need in order to to drive, you have to have a certain amount of energy, a certain amount of, you have to have a certain genetic expression to use certain materials. Like, I now look at it as if anybody on Earth who is having experiences with aliens is expressing certain, and spiritually and genetically expressing something the aliens are looking for and are breeding for in order to be able to use their technology.
I wanted to ask you about experiences that we might call really high strangeness. And one that stood out to me was when you went out walking and you came across a brass band in a ravine.
Yeah, it wasn't a brass band in a ravine. That was a screen memory. It was a screen memory there was probably a ship in there somewhere, but all I saw was a brass band in the ravine underneath the high tension lines. Somebody was probably refueling, and it might have been somebody I knew. But I felt like this person, you know, that I talked to was the nearest and dearest person in the world to me. It was like leading this brass band. And, you know, just having, even having like a fox lead me there, like, hey, I'm 3 years old and I'm following a fox because the fox keeps looking back at me. And I knew horse body language, like if a horse looks back at you and then continues forward and then looks back at you, it means come with me. And the fox was doing, you know, look back at me, continue forward, look back at me. So I'm following this fox and I follow it into the ravine and I follow it to, you know, this brass band of whatever. And that's a screen memory. And that gets really confusing for a lot of people. When you're 3, you just go, okay, you know, there's a brass band underneath the high power lines in the ravine. Okay. You know, okay, I hope I meet that person again. And what was really sad is I kept looking to meet that person or that person that I talked to again. I would go back there and look for them and I couldn't find them. So there was a lot of sort of bittersweet memory. I was like, well, when are they going to come back?
So when you saw the brass band, were they all in like uniform and there were trombone players and trumpet players and things?
You got you. I don't know what the upside down boat hats, the canoe hats are. I forgot, but they were all gray. They all had on a gray uniform and they all had very short cropped hair, which means they were probably bald. But the hats they had on were like one, I think it was Air Force, but I'm not sure. But they had on what I call the gray upside down boat hats. And they had chairs. They had folding chairs and they had all of the instruments that you would need in a brass band, woodwinds and trombones and, you know, the whole thing. And there were at least 30 of them, you know, it was like, oh, I'm like 30 of them. Huh, interesting. What are they doing? They're practicing in the ravine. Why? And there's no roads into it, you know. There wasn't like there was a double track that you, and I didn't see any cars, you know, to drop them off like you would in a normal situation. So yeah, it was definitely a screen memory. And that I wrote about that to show, hey, you know, you got to watch out for your screen memories. If something feels like it just doesn't follow, it's a screen memory.
It's so bizarre, isn't it, that they would choose that? And it's almost like they knew you were coming, so they presented something that was not scary when they gave you that
image. Exactly. Yeah, it was. I was not scared. You know, who knows if the fox was actually a fox? I think it was a fox because animals are very telepathic, so it's very easy to sort of not. I wouldn't say hijack them, but to work with them if you're working on the telepathic level. So, and they're all working on the telepathic level. You know, so yeah, it was non-scary, and this is something I've watched. Sometimes my heart hurts because not every experience I've had has been terrible and scary and painful. Some have been like really loving and kind and more love than you get from human beings. You know, but just the energy of love, the energy of openness of heart. And then sometimes it's just awful. And, you know, and I was a brat. I threw a lot of little aliens up against the wall and cracked their heads open, you know, when it was awful, when I didn't want to be doing something. So I'm not going to pull punches and say, oh, well, these aliens are good and these are aliens are bad, which I hear some people saying now, you know, that David Jacobs aliens are bad and the John Mack aliens are bad. And it's like, it's not that simple, right? Like sometimes the experiences are really good and really kind, and sometimes they're not what you want to have happening to you and your body and your, and what's going on. And there are different groups of aliens. And even the ones you would consider bad, not all of them are bad. Just like people. Yeah, sorry. This is my rant of the moment. I've been watching a lot of Farsight. I love you, Courtney, but you need to stop saying these are the bad aliens and these are the good aliens, because you know what? They're not all just bad or all good. It's complicated, and you just got to be able to handle complicated if you want to know, like, if you're an experiencer, somebody out there is an experiencer, and they're going through your own stuff, don't let somebody else make you make snap judgments on black, white, good, bad. Just go through your experiences. You don't need an expert telling you this is good, this is bad. You just need to go through your own experiences.
Well, I wanted to ask about another incident before we move on. When you were sitting down in the kitchen and you were colouring in a book, and
yeah,
then there was a missing time, was there?
I think there was an alien behind me. So my grandfather was a graphic artist. I didn't know that. He was a banker and a graphic artist. He was a pretty cool grandfather when it came to like making sure that I could color outside the lines and I could draw my own pictures in my coloring book. And he took care of me when I was, a pre-kindergarten age. And I can't remember if it was probably kindergarten, because he was around for most of kindergarten. But one day I was coloring in my book, and I think aliens showed up, because he was at the kitchen sink with his back to me, and I asked him a question and he turned to answer the question. And then all of a sudden he got this strange look on his face, and he picked up a butter knife that he was washing, and he threw it over my left shoulder, which is where the doorway was. I was sort of sitting off to the right of the doorway into the kitchen, looking out the kitchen window. There was a window over the sink, so you could see the backyard or you see the neighbor's yards while you were washing dishes. You know, it wasn't boring. And so all of a sudden he picked up this knife and he flung it like he really was trying to get something. He wasn't trying to get me. You know, if he had wanted to, I was so close, he could have hit me with that knife. And what happened is my sister was coming around the corner of the other room just after that. She saw the knife go flying through the air, and he wasn't aiming at her. The timing was not right. I think there was a little gray man coming to do like a missing time. And my grandfather just did the best he could do and flung a knife at it. Well, it ended up not working out well, because I don't ever remember being spanked or hit or hurt in any way by my grandfather. But because my sister told my mother that he threw a butter knife at me, he was kicked out of the house. And it was terrible, because I perceived that butter knife was not meant for me. Right? He would have hit me if he wanted to hit me with a butter knife, And we were having a fine time. I'm coloring in my book, and I just asked him a question, and it wasn't a stupid question. And he wasn't angry at me a moment before. And all of a sudden this butter knife goes flying toward the dining room door through the kitchen, and with some anger and some force, and from a person that wasn't angry a moment before. Yeah. And didn't show me anger or anything else. So I really think he was throwing it at an alien that had come pick me up. I think that alien scooted, but it did not go well, because then my grandfather was gone. I missed him a lot after that.
And you never got a chance to talk to him about it?
Never got a chance to talk to him about it. My mom would not let it go. And then a sad thing is that my mom knew the alien stuff was happening, but she literally had tamped her mind down around it so far because it was so terrifying to her. So my sister had a memory of an event just after my grandfather left. It was summertime. My mom is hanging up clothes. I'm out playing next to her while she's hanging up clothes. And my sister and my brother are somewhere in the house or in the yard, close by, not too far away. And I think it's springtime. It feels like it's April or May. It's like that kind of perfect spring weather when it's not too hot, not too cold, not too buggy in Michigan. All of a sudden, this spaceship shows up over the clothesline, which is like this clothes thing on a pole, and that's round, you know, pentagon shaped. And it shows up over the top of it. It's over my mom's head and it's over me. My mom looks up, sees it. She grabs me and shrieks. I think she grabs my sister off the porch, and she goes in the house and she grabs my brother, and she finds the deepest closet in the house that she can fit everybody in. And she throws me on the bottom of the pile, my sister over me and my brother over my sister and herself on top. And in order to protect the aliens, me from the aliens picking me up. Okay. And I'm like 6, maybe 7 at most. My sister remembers that what that meant was not mom was being such a good mom and she knew about the aliens. She remembers it as she liked you better than me because she threw you on the bottom.
Oh. You
know? So then we have the sister with the understanding that she is not the favorite because she didn't get thrown on the bottom. Rather than, no, you're not the one who's being targeted. It doesn't have anything to do with favorite. She was still putting herself over the top of all of us, right? It's so sad. And there's been since in my life this sort of competition about, you know, who's beloved the most. And it's like, just stop it. You know, it's none of it was ever about that. It was who's the target. I was the target. So my mom, in her own way, knew. Like she knew. She's, you know, having a hard time protecting this little kid. And then she'd forget. They'd come, they'd switch everybody off, and she'd forget too.
There's a couple of kind of verifications in other ways as well, isn't there? Is it a guy called David McKenna? And he saw you on a ship?
Oh, yeah. And his stuff, I've been trying to go into the Akashic Records and talk to him. His stuff had like a... You can get like a 50-year restraining order on information and spirit, or I'm not the person to look at it. So I've been waiting for his 50 years to be up to see what he saw and what our relationship was. But yes, he was. So it sounds like I'm bragging in the book, but I'm not. I'm not diagnosed with Asperger's or ADHD, but school was always really easy for me. And I was a National Merit Scholar. I had a National Merit Scholarship. So and that's based on taking the PSAT, the pre-SAT, and the there's another test that isn't the SAT. But I did really good on test taking. So at one point, my IQ was like tested at 161, and then I was at the top of everybody who took the PSAT in my school, and it was the 12th best public school in the U.S. So certain things were just super, super easy for me to pick up. And the way other kids responded to me, it was like they would come to me like I was the one who knew what was going on, right? Okay, I'm getting back to this. I'm not trying to brag here. In the book, it'll sound like I'm bragging, but my point is that the aliens do stuff to your head. You don't have to be autistic or have Asperger's or hyperfocus or anything like that. They do stuff so that you learn, right? You learn faster, you learn quicker, you learn better, or you're seeing through everything to what the actual answer is, because we are living in a space that's basically a holograph. And if you can cut through the holograph really quickly to get to what the answer is, then you just have the answer. That's better than having to take all this time and go, well, I don't remember that. I don't remember this. I don't remember the other thing. It's like, well, it's in the holograph and it's right there. And that's the answer. So the psychic ability stuff, that is part of the gene expression, but they also do stuff to you when you're a kid and when you're a young adult that makes it more, right? Okay, where did we start this from? Sorry, I went off on a tangent.
David McKenna, and he saw you on a ship?
Right, so David McKenna and I were both in a gifted after school program for gifted students. And I was in the first year, and it was the first year the teacher, Alice Bailey, when she saw me coming down the pipe with this ridiculous IQ, she convinced, she was a sixth grade teacher, and I came down the pike and some other kids came down the pike with really high IQs. And she said, we need a gifted after school program. These guys are, they're bored. They're going to get bored. They need projects to do. They're going to be project learners. You're going to have to take the focus that they have and put it into something that they're interested in. So she started the program the first year I was in sixth grade. And that was fine. Everything was good. The year I was in seventh grade, David McKenna showed up. He was in sixth grade and he had a ridiculously high IQ. And, you know, and the problem was he was remembering all of his alien experiences and he was writing in his books about, you know, he was referring it all to the Lord of the Rings and the Silmarillion, that the aliens weren't aliens, they were fairies, you know, and they were going to come and take us off the planet because the planet was going to crap and, you know, all of these other things. And we're in the Cold War, mind you. So like, if we do have a nuclear bomb hit, and even if we do in the future, it's not too far-fetched to think some aliens are going to come and take us off the planet. And anyway, he was saying, and they won't take everyone, but they'll take me and they'll take her. So David McKenna had seen me naked on a ship, because when they work on you, a lot of times you're naked. Okay. So you're a preteen girl, you're 7 years, seventh grader, you're going through puberty, and all of a sudden you have the sixth grader saying, staring at you saying, I've seen you naked. I've seen you naked on a ship. And you're going, you're a weirdo stalker, dude. Get the heck away from me. I quit the gifted after school program because David McKenna could not stop saying stuff about seeing me naked on a ship. And did I remember, and trying to telepathically have me look into his eyes like the aliens would look into your eyes. And I was just like, this weirdo won't leave me alone. And this is really uncomfortable. And all the other kids are going, what the heck is going on? So I was like, I'm out of here. Just leave me alone. Don't even call me back. So what ended up happening is he kept talking about me to other friends that we had in common. And he kept all of these journals. And then my senior year and his junior year, he ended up dead, naked on the floor of his bedroom with a hole in his head that was cauterized with no blood. And the house was locked up and his dad was the sheriff.
Yeah, because it kind of looked like a suicide, but there was no weapon there and it was all locked up.
And it was all locked up. Yeah. So if you've been through the aliens, and this is terrifying, right? You know, and I had had dreams about him. I had dreams like telling him, don't do that. You're going to end up dead. You know, like certain things he would end up doing. And I'd be like, oh, no, don't do that. You're going to end up dead. So anyway, he had written about me in his journals and in all of this information about, you know, elves coming in ships and things like that. And there he is on the floor, dead with a hole in his head that's cauterized. No blood loss like you get from a head wound. And everybody, all of the adults, I had a friend, I call her Emma. Her dad was the district attorney. And he's in the middle of this, and his daughter, Emma, is being written about in these journals as well as I am. And Emma's one of my good friends, and her older sister is my age, and we're really good friends. Carrie is in the book, is a really good friend. And Emma was really good friends with David McKenna. So anyway, they get these journals. They're trying to figure out what's going on because it doesn't make any sense. His father is phenomenally upset because even for police standards, it doesn't make any sense. We don't realize this is going on. I just get told, you know, Emma gets really upset. So we leave school one day and go have a conversation about David, and we go walk through the woods and talk about David. And she's not suicidal. Like she was, somebody had been calling her on the phone with like a weird voice, like the guy who is from Colorado writes about this, like it's a computerized voice. You can't tell if it's male or female. And they'll call on the phone and it doesn't really sound like deep throat. You can't tell if it's male or female. Anyway, somebody kept calling her and telling her that she really wanted to kill herself. She wanted to go get her father's gun and kill herself. And they kept calling her. And so backing up, this is just after David. This is like a week after David dies. She's having this voice call her on the phone. And I am about to do my math homework and I get this voice in my head says really clearly, call Emma. And I'm like having to cook dinner and do my math homework. And the voice says again, call Emma. And then again, call Emma. So I call her and I say, Emma, what are you doing? And she goes, I have a gun up to my head and I was going to pull the trigger. And I'm like, well, put it down. And she goes, this person thing keeps calling me on the phone, telling me I should kill myself. And I'm like, well, don't listen to them and don't answer the phone. She goes, well, the phone will keep ringing. Let your mom answer it. They're not going to tell your mom to kill herself. She's like, oh, right. I'm like, yeah, that'll just ignore them. You know, they'll go away. And then I went out in the woods and I walked with her and I talked about David and what was going on with these phone calls. And I hung out with her the rest of the week. And in the process of hanging out with her, we were both abducted from her downstairs. And not knowing that her dad, the district attorney, knew all this weird stuff about David McKenna's death. And regardless of the fact that one of the teachers who found out that I skipped class to go talk with her and walking in the woods was like, you can't talk down a friend who's suicidal. And I'm like, well, she's not really suicidal. It's somebody like trying to mind control her into doing it. That's different. You know, we're still hanging out and we get abducted. And it's her dad who's on high alert that is because he knows all the stuff about David McKenna's death being mysterious. He sees lights on the lawn. He hears noises in the house and he goes to check on everybody. He gets down to the basement where we're on this large semicircular couch sleeping end to end and we're gone. We're just not there. So he calls, you know, the town police, the sheriffs, the county sheriffs, our parents, my parents, and they're all out looking for us for hours. In the meantime, the men in black show up or somebody, they say they're the FBI, but they don't leave any of the right paperwork. I have an FBI forensic friend who said, no, they weren't FBI. They would have left paperwork. They show up at my house. They take my journals to see what I've been writing about. And I never get those back. And somewhere when everybody's outside of the house looking for us, we get put back on the couch and we don't remember anything. And so we wake up in the morning and Emma's mom is making this ginormous, beautiful breakfast spread and saying, get up, it's time for you to come to breakfast. And her dad, who's the district attorney, as we sit down to this beautiful, like fresh raspberries and strawberries and scrambled eggs and, you know, anything you could possibly want in middle America for breakfast and hot chocolate, whatever you want. I'm like, wow. And I'm looking at it. And Emma's looking at me like, something's wrong. And I'm like, does your mom? And I'm looking at her going, does your mom normally do this? She's like, no. And so this isn't like a Sunday morning thing. She's like, no. And she goes, something's wrong. And her dad proceeds to grill me on where we were the night before and not tell us that everybody was out looking for us. It's really quite hysterical if it weren't so terrifying, right? It's like, it's really funny. We have no idea. It was like, what a great morning. Somebody's giving us everything to eat. And that's a pivotal point in the book, because if that had never happened, I never would have gotten afraid of aliens, I think. And I might have tried to ignore them for a long, 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 much longer time.
It was a point where you were abducted and people saw that you were missing, because that doesn't seem to turn up so much with the people, that the aliens seem to be a bit more sneaky than that and only take people when it won't be spotted. But then didn't you have like a whole week went missing?
Well, nobody. Yeah. The other thing was, it was when I was, oh gosh, was I 20 or 21? It was 20 or 21. I was working. Yeah. I think I was 21. I was working in downtown Boston, at the Lafayette Place, motel shops below the motel, which is a Swiss hotel. And I was working in a jewelry store and I was their best salesperson. So they did not want to fire me. I left on a Friday night, closed up the shop. I was the last one there, closed up, went home and proceeded to have a week of missing time where when I woke up in the morning, I thought it was Saturday morning. I went into work for when the shops opened at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning and opened up the shop and nobody else was open. And I'm looking around going, okay, how come nobody is open? How come nobody is here? And then one of the plainclothes policemen, you know, security guys came by and said, why are you open? I said, well, you know, shops open at 9 on Saturday. And he goes, it's Sunday. And I went, what? He goes, it's Sunday. And I thought, oh my God, I missed a whole day. What happened to Saturday? Well, come to find out when my boss finally came in, and they didn't even want to bring it up. They were like waiting for me to tell them what happened. And I'm like acting like, you know, I don't know. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. I don't know what happened to Saturday. They had to tell me I missed an entire week and that I hadn't called in. And they ended up firing me because I didn't call in and I couldn't give them a good reason why I was gone for a week. And they'd ask me and I'd say, I literally don't know. All I know is I went to bed and I woke up and I thought it was Saturday the next morning. So I have some thoughts about that now, but I, you know.
And you just don't know where you were or what you did?
I think I know where I was now, but I don't really want to get into it. And I think I know what I was doing, but you know, that opens up a whole other can of worms, which is best dealt with differently than in this little bit of time.
Okay.
But I was gone for a week. Yeah. I was gone for a week and I got fired. It was gross. I mean, it was terrible because I was their best person. They didn't want to fire me, but they really wanted an excuse why I didn't call in and why I was so disrespectful. And I wasn't. I just didn't know what the heck had happened.
Can I ask you about your experience of working with John Mack? Because you were one of his first research subjects. Is that right?
Right. And that's the weirdest to say. You were a patient. No, we were never patients. And I think John was great. And I think some of the attempts to, I don't know what, I'll just say John was great. He was a child trauma psychiatrist. He knew his stuff. He was open-minded as much as he could be. I don't know if he had Asperger's, but he had hyper-focus like you wouldn't believe. Took notes on everything, intently listened and very presently listened, and was open to whatever you came up with, you know, when you're in your experiences while you were under hypnosis, but even in, you know, just telling your story that didn't require hypnosis, he really listened and he really took notes. And of course, you know, psychiatrists do that. They take notes, but you can tell from their affect how much they're judging you. He was a very non-judgmental guy. You know, his affect did not say, I'm judging you. I've been to other where, you know, it's like, oh, I see you just tensed up. You don't want to hear that. Okay, well, let's be empathetic to my psychiatrist here and not go serve. John Mack didn't have any of that. He didn't have any of that. When it first started out, sometimes he'd get a little tense, but as time went on, he was like, nope, he'd just take notes, he'd just listen. And he'd take his time to ask questions. Like you could see if there was a pause, he paused and he wanted to ask a question, he'd really think about how to ask it. It's just generally a kind person who totally ripped up his own life to do this research. And it's unfortunate.
Do you feel that when he started out, he didn't believe this phenomenon was really what it is, but over time he changed his mind and he thought there really is something happening here?
No, I think he was pulling his punches for his Harvard compatriots because of political reasons. I think he always believed us when we told him what was going on. Didn't have to sound as crazy as we did to people at Harvard. And, you know, there are videos now of him saying, yeah, it is physical. It is a physical thing, you know, but it felt like such a betrayal when I saw in the book. He's like, well, you know, maybe it's a spiritual thing coming on and to make a spiritual correction. It's like, dude, dumb nugget, you know, that is because I had an implant in my head. I was that went to MIT and then Ann Arbor and back to MIT and was also at Harvard in the forensics lab. And that was made out of carbon-13, which we now know as graphene, and it was rolled and it had a braided structure. And well, now, 20 years later, you find out that graphene makes a quantum computer. And, you know, how do we get this thing out of my head, which doesn't make any sense? And you're saying it's not physical. Why is it that they're taking children that has to do with genetics if it's not physical? So it's like, when he said that, we're all just going, you dumb nugget. He was totally pulling his punches. He had more than enough information that it was a physical thing, but he was just trying to ease everybody else into it without it, you know, without totally wrecking his credibility. And then they still tried to wreck his credibility, you know, so the Harvard inquiry was just a just we were infiltrated by PsyCop, and this person just tried to divide and conquer our entire support group and get Harvard in a, oh, it was terrible. It was a terrible, terrible situation to be on top of something that was already traumatic. So anyway, don't blame, not John Mack's fault. It's other people who are invested in keeping the worldview, keeping the dominant paradigm in play. So we're all not awake and don't know what's going on.
I think there was a time where you would dream of going on a school bus.
Oh yeah. So elementary school. Yeah. Elementary school and kindergarten. Yeah.
Was there a time you were walking with your grandfather and you saw the kids?
Yeah, that was before, I think it was either before kindergarten or it was a school bus that went in the way that the school bus ended up going, but there were kids on it that I didn't know from school. And so one of them ended up being like my best friend in high school, who I don't really write about. I think I call her Wendy. She was on that school bus. There were other kids. These two little girls were on that school bus, I believe. But the school bus had different kids on it. Okay. It wasn't the kids that I went to school with. So, and this kind of ties into David McKenna's, that there was a group of kids that he wrote about who, abductee, and I was an abductee, and Emma was an abductee, were probably all abductees. And to me, when I look back on it, that school bus, which is a screen memory, is, you know, all of the kids getting picked up that are abductees and going to school. And there is a school, go deeper into experiences, like people just go to the traumatic stuff. There is a school component of being a child experiencer, teach you to do stuff like kinetics and telepath stuff and reviewing stuff and floating. Somebody who's a little bit older than you teach you how to float, who is human. So there's all sorts of stuff that you learn. And, you know, sometimes they're like group circles that you get in with the other kids that are in the area.
Is this contact still happening or is it kind of petered out over time?
It changed. So I changed my agreement with the universe and with the aliens. I went through a whole process. Whether you believe in religious things or not, there's certain religious icons that have power. So I had a powwow with Mother Mary, Archangel Michael, and the head aliens that were abducting me, all the aliens that were abducting me. And I said, I'm not doing this anymore. And I'm going to choose to leave this body if you keep doing certain things to me in this relationship, because I am in too much pain. And I don't know how long I'm going to be able to have any quality of life if you keep doing this. So we're changing this agreement. We're changing it now. By free will, I say no more. And it was really like, you really have to mean it and be, you have to be certain of it if you're going to change your agreement with them. Some people can say like, oh, I said the Lord's Prayer and they left. And it's like, well, that's great. You must have been really certain. But what about all the other times you don't remember? So anyway, I was really certain of it. I changed my agreement. And in my agreement, I picked up a different job. And my case is a little bit different because I have two kids that are fully human. And so when I picked up a different job, it was, they don't abduct me. They don't do anything to my body, but I do help. I help things that will help people and will help them. And I'm still able to see the two kids that I'm close to that are fully human. I've had those experiences. I was able, my son that they have was with somebody on Earth, and he ended up having a kind of dwarfism that's arthrochondritis. So he had genetic issues, and he was going to, if he would, what they have is a probability field reader, which when you get into the next book, I can explain that. But they looked at the probability field reader of how my life would be if I had this kid on Earth. So I had a son who had special needs who grew up with aliens, but I went back and forth to see him relatively often. And he ended up working when he grew up on the project with me that I was in. That project has been curtailed in the past year and a half, 2 years, because there's a different exopolitical situation going on that's quite concerning. We don't need to get into, because it's not about my childhood. But anyway, I would see my son. I would go see him as he was growing up. I had a daughter who was fully human who I was from because when I was younger and the aliens would present her to me, I'd say, she's not my daughter. And I'd be kind of not a good mom because I hadn't to understand the situation. And so I'm now close with my daughter and close with my son, close with my grandson, close with my son-in-law. And then I have my son has a godfather type figure. And I do things in my working group with them. Courtney Brown were to say, these are the good aliens. These are the Estesani resistance movement aliens. You know, that's what he'd say. But, you know, they're actually embedded within the aliens that will still like make you not very happy if you get abducted by them. So all of the time. So, you know, it's complicated. I do and I don't. I don't get abducted. And lately things are because there's another thing going on where somebody is willfully shooting down ships. And so everybody is like clamped down, not traveling, not doing things.
Well, it's been great talking to you. We've almost run out of time. The book's called Experience, Memoirs of an Abducted Childhood, and people can get that on Amazon. And could you tell us about your other books? Are they available?
No, I haven't finished them yet. I've been working on a second book called Inquiry, which is about going, what we mainly most of this talk since childhood has been about working with Dr. Mack and the Harvard Inquiry and what happened there and what happened with the experiencers that are most are now past, at least my core group of friends. So Inquiry, I've been told by my editor, who is not paid, you know, but he's getting older, so he's going to be passing on soon. He's like, you got to do it now. And I'm like, okay. We hope that'll come up in the next year. And I will try not to run on and tell too many stories, but just keep it simple for very complicated information. So I want to do that. And then there's another one about after that. Those aren't out yet. Hopefully I'll get them out of my head, at least Inquiry out of my head. And onto paper. Experience, it's a lot of pages, but it's actually not that many words. I set up the font so that people with older eyes would not have words all run together. So if you have to use eyeglasses, you'll understand what I mean when you see the actual book. But it goes up to the point when I meet Dr. Mack. And some people say too many things are happening, but I argue that anybody who has this in their family will be like, it will at least give you verification if you've had similar experiences and at least point to, okay, yeah, that's me or that's not me. Oh, no, that's not me. So I did that for other experiences. These books in my mind are written for people who really want to know how complicated it can get, and also for experiencers who may have had similar experiences, to have somebody saying, oh, see, yeah, it's not just me. I'm not just alone with all this.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Which I think is more important than anything in my book. So I do readings and I do remote viewings for people. I do medical intuition and animal communication and timeline probability field readings and Akashic record readings. So although I agree with Simon that sometimes the best thing to have is a past life regression if you're looking into who you were in a past life, because it's good to experience it yourself, but I can look at Akashic records. And right now, the best website is realspiritmedium.com. I had elizabethanglin.com, and for some reason, for the past year, I have not been able to get that to point to the right place. So go to realspiritmedium.com if you are looking for a reading or want to join my mailing list or find out more.
Great. And I'll put links in the show notes. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having the podcast and letting me ramble on. I really appreciate it.
That's great. And that was an interview with Elizabeth Anglin about her book, Experience, Memoirs of an Abducted Childhood. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode, just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try the extended episodes, you can now get a 7-day free trial. There are two tiers. In the $3 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. And in the $6 a month tier, you get an extended episode every week. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Our Paranormal Afterlife, and there are over 300 episodes. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review, and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. If someone was to spend time with you, I suppose as a house guest, would they notice things happening? Or do you think that the ETs would just switch them off and they would never notice anything?
Well, so the problem was in 97, I made the mistake. It wasn't a mistake. I put a 2-mile radius restraining order on any aliens that abduct.